You're listening to the OCD Stories podcast, hosted by me, Stuart Ralph. The OCD Stories is a podcast dedicated to raising awareness and understanding around obsessive compulsive symptoms. I do this through interviewing inspired therapists, psychologists, and people who have experienced OCD. Welcome to the OCD Stories. And welcome to episode 282. And in this episode, it's a little different. It's my first panel or round table podcast. And basically, that just means I have multiple guests on talking about one particular topic. And in this case, it's about acceptance and commitment therapy for OCD. So I interview Dr. Michael Tuhig, a licensed psychologist and researcher, Dr. Patricia Zurita Ona, a clinical psychologist, and Johnny Say, an integrative counselor. So they have two things in common, or two obvious things in common. One is they're all trained in ACT, and the other is that they've all been on the show before. So if you want to find out more about them or their episodes, I'll put all the links and information in the show notes, which you can find at theocdstories.com. But really, really interesting podcast. Interesting for me to kind of take this different format. I hope you guys find it useful. So in it, we talk about their backgrounds and what brought them into acceptance and commitment therapy, or ACT for short, where ACT adds value to OCD treatment, how they use ACT alongside exposure and response prevention therapy. We discuss the compulsion of rumination and how ACT can target it, how ACT targets other difficult emotions that can go alongside OCD, such as disgust, shame, guilt, etc. How ACT can work on other issues alongside OCD, other issues meaning comorbidities or just general life problems or stresses. How values are useful to guiding life decisions. So I hope there's something in this for you. And thanks to NoCD for supporting the show. NoCD are dedicated to creating a better everyday life for people with OCD. They now operate in the US, UK and Australia. To find out more, head to go.treatmyocd.com/theocdstories or click the link in the episode description. And as always, thank you so much for listening. I deeply appreciate it. And without further ado, here is Michael, Patricia and Johnny. Welcome back to the show, Patricia, Michael and Johnny.
Thank you so much for having us back.
Great to be here again.
Yes, thanks.
So yeah, thank you for being here and doing this kind of roundtable discussion on ACT. I think it will be good, hopefully. Well, I've no doubt it will be good. So let's start with, you know, most people hopefully heard the episodes that you guys have been on my podcast. But if you could just give a brief, an ACT introduction about yourself, like, yeah, your experience and history with ACT.
Yeah, so I guess, you know, anyone who heard my episode before knows that I have struggled with OCD in the past and, you know, have found immense value in acceptance and commitment therapy and compassion-focused therapy to help me deal with that. I am now a therapist myself. I'm working in the NHS, National Health Service, and private practice over here in the UK, and I work with a mixture of struggles and human challenges, OCD being one of them. And I continue to see the value in ACT and just developing psychological flexibility and all the good stuff we're going to talk about as we get on. I guess my training in ACT is I've trained with Russ Harris, with Steve Hayes, with Kelly Wilson, and with Kirk Stroh. Also, I've done bits of training with all of those guys, and then Patricia has taught me a lot as well. I've worked with her as well.
Excellent. Thanks, Johnny. Michael, do you want to go next?
Sure. So I'm probably in this group. I'm more of a researcher of ACT for OCD and related problems. I've been at it my whole career, which is about 20 years long. I do have a private practice. I have a small amount of clients, and then I'm also a professor at Utah State University where I run an ACT research group with Mike Levin. And in there, we have 10 grad students, and I run a clinic part of the university where I train students in ACT. So, this particular thing we're talking about is, you know, kind of where I spend a pretty good chunk of every day for the last long time.
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, on your episode, you shared that you are really the person leading the way in looking at ACT specifically for OCD back in the early 2000s when no one was really looking at it at OCD and ACT. So we're largely here because of your work, I guess.
That's nice of you to say. I mean, I don't know if I'd say it that way. Steve published a paper on ACT for OCD in 87. Then certainly other people have been doing the work with me. But I think I do have a benefit in that I'm a researcher, you know. So maybe where I'm more known are the papers on this topic. So, yeah, I had a little benefit in getting to put some of the initial work out.
Yeah, cool. Well, no, thank you. And Patricia?
Well, thank you again for having us back. I am located in California, and I was introduced to ACT, I think, around 2004, maybe, long time ago. I'm more like a dinosaur. And over the years, I immerse myself all the way into learning more psychological processes to target psychological flexibility. And I feel very fortunate, like Johnny, I have attended many boot camps, trainings, workshops, read all the books, consult with Mike too. And I think that ACT has helped me on a personal level to be a better human being, because I can dance with my fears and my struggles in a more, I think, compassionate way. And also in my clinical work, I have seen the impact of teaching ACT skills and ACT processes to all my clients dealing with OCD, with social anxiety, with panic attacks, or with any forms of fear-based struggles. So I'm always excited to talk about it. And I am super passionate also to show how that the combo of ACT and ERP can go in every single moment when we're working with clients and in our lives.
Yeah. Yeah, good point. And what came to me there, what you said about personally, it helped you learn to dance with your difficult emotions and fears. And you didn't say it, but what came up for me was you learned to dance with it instead of trying to get rid of it.
Yeah. I think that is, thank you for pinpointing that. I think before, when I had fears of loneliness or thoughts about not being good enough or feeling unseen, I may have done all types of things to push harder or to just pretend those feelings maybe weren't there, or trying to rationalize those feelings. I think when I start learning more about acceptance and learning to step back and watch my experiences, the relationship and how I handle with those experiences completely shift, has become much more gentle. I think there is so much more caring that comes when I'm having those feelings, which I didn't know before ACT.
Nice. Thank you for sharing. So today I've got you all on to talk about some of the more bigger questions around ACT for OCD. So we're not going to be discussing kind of, you know, sort of beginner type questions of, you know, what is ACT? And because definitely go listen to any one of the episodes I recorded with you guys, and hopefully that will address a lot of those questions. This is more really to go a bit deeper. So the first one is, and Michael, we did actually discuss this in your episode, was there's no real evidence to show that ACT adds incremental value above and beyond sort of traditional CBT for OCD. So I'm really going to put it out there again. So what's the point of ACT and OCD? ACT for OCD.
I feel like that was sort of tossed at me. Are you okay with me answering that?
Yeah, go for it.
Well, you know, for the journey for me, and I just gave a talk on this yesterday, like we just did a meta-analysis, came out in 2015, and I had all the CBT trials for OCD in it, and the pre to post response rates 45 and the pre to follow up response rates 36%. Right. So on the one hand, that's great. And on the other hand, right, it's not that amazing. Like a 36% response rate of follow up means like we have a lot of distance to go. I feel like the line of work is leading to this idea of like acceptance and tolerance is really a key idea in the treatment of OCD and anxiety disorders. Like we have a study that says the This is where we're coding the videos of ERP and ACT plus ERP sessions. And a really good acceptance or tolerance rationale is the best predictor of treatment outcome. So if you really can help the client see that idea, that's where you're going to get the best outcome. So no, you're absolutely right. We're not seeing it when people do head-to-head trials, but the kind of the idea behind ACT seems to be really important in the treatment of anxiety disorders and OCD, that learning how to be open to one's thoughts, feelings, and emotions, not fighting against them. And, you know, like when I worked with John Abramowitz, one of the things he said is, and I think he wouldn't mind me repeating this, that he thinks ACT's a really nice way to teach response prevention. And I think it's true. I think the concept of response prevention is wonderful, but how do you describe that to a client? To like allow this thing to be there, not fight with it, and just let it. I mean, I feel like people have developed really nice ways to do it, but is in like a technology, I think ACT has offered that. So, you know, where is this going to be in a long, long time? You know, I don't know, but I think the idea behind ACT is kind of at the core of the treatment of a lot of anxiety disorders.
Yeah, really good point. And I think it's worth me adding, like, ACT alone, when you originally were doing the research, showed that it was effective up to the point of ERP being effective. Obviously, there wasn't as many randomized control trials, so that's obviously an issue. But it was more the question of when you add ACT onto ERP, there was no additional value. So I guess I just throw that in, just so anyone thinking ACT is actually useful, and you've proven that. It was more the trials you did where you added ACT to ERP, that's where there was no sort of change.
No, there's no difference, but it's a cool study that it's like Tuig et al. 2018. And our response rate, each condition at post was 65%. So we had a pretty strong response rate, which is like, that's when you heard what I just said, that's 20% higher than the average you'd be getting. So I think we were doing it pretty nicely in both conditions.
Yeah. Excellent. Thank you. And open it up to Patricia or Johnny.
Well, I would add, you know, another perspective to that as well. You know, I'm a huge advocate for research and love, you know, Michael's work and exploring and discovering that. But I also think there's value in listening to our clients and to listening to the community. And actually, when you read the major number of recovery stories, they often read like acceptance and commitment therapy stories. You know, when you speak to these people, you know, often there is this quality of acceptance and really opening up and creating the struggle as opposed to symptom reduction. And I think in my own journey, symptom reduction was the problem, right? That was the whole thing. That was 20 odd years trying to get symptom reduction, trying all kinds of different things. And then for me, ACT is such a relief, because it's like, actually, I'm not going for symptom reduction anymore. I'm going for having the choices of where I put my focus, where I put my energy and attention, what I do with my life, how I live my life, how I handle those emotions and thoughts that are common to everyone. And, you know, I hear that a lot. So, you know, I've had the chance of speaking to people who've been through NHS treatments, had ERP. You read the notes and you read the scores and they've recovered. And then you speak to them and you hear that actually they couldn't tell you a thing about ERP, how it works, what they did, and they're still struggling with it. You know, and of course, that's a small subset and that's not everyone. But, you know, I definitely think we need to listen to the community and listen to advocates and listen to, you know, people out there alongside, you know, this amazing, robust research. And for me, everything I hear confirms an acceptance and values-based approach, and everything in my own mind and life sort of speaks to that. And maybe one thing on the response prevention, I can't imagine doing response prevention without training mindfulness skills and awareness. From my own experience of OCD, it can just be so prevalent all day long. Your mind is doing these compulsions, and if you've had 20 years of that, you don't even know you're doing it half the time. So without some sort of training and awareness and ability to watch your mind and step back, I can't imagine how you would do it, really, to some degree.
Yeah, thank you.
If I can add a little bit, it's such an interesting question. I just want to tap a little bit into, for me as a clinician, seeing clients every single day, most of my clients are coming with OCD and social anxiety, OCD and a specific phobia, OCD and depression. Few times I have this very, you know, solo OCD presentation. I think what we have is more the comorbidity, the coexistence of OCD and extra stuff. And I think that even though both approaches, ACT and ERP, are both very successful, with ACT, I think you have so much more flexibility to tackle fear-based struggles, to tackle, let's say, social anxiety and OCD. There have been a couple of cases in which I also have treated trauma and OCD, or OCD and a specific phobia. So I think targeting comorbidity, that's something very unique within the ACT model, because you're tackling process, right? We're teaching a person to approach what they're scared of in the service of what is important to them. The other variable here, I agree with what John is saying. I think that, Mike, you know the stats much better than myself, but we know that exposure work has been extremely effective for years. It has helped many, many people. But we also know that in research settings, there are people that don't start treatment because they get the scare. And I think it's maybe 30 to 33% on average. And if they start treatment, they discontinue treatment because this idea of facing our fears can be scary. And then also we have a relapse of people after they finish ERP. The reason why this is important to keep in the background is because one size of exposure treatment doesn't work. So even though, yes, the data is showing that both treatments are effective, how it looks in the room can be maybe more approachable for other people who are very scared, for people that has also comorbid conditions, for people who are struggling with obsessions that come with a lot of shame, like fears of being a pedophile, fears of being a murderer, fears of attacking your family or your kids. So I think the idea, as Johnny was saying, of teaching people more acceptance-based skills upfront and looking at values, what's important for you, why in the world we're going to face this, makes a difference in the work.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. A good setup. And I guess my next question then, kind of leading on from that, is from, and I guess each of the questions are asked, you know, the key, you can answer it however you want, but I'm happy to answer from like a research position, from a clinician position, and from your own personal experience as individual human beings, and any other position there is in the world, I'm not sure, other than those three. Observer, there you go. What are some of the ways that you like that you bring ACT into an ERP model? It's a really open question. Just obviously you could do structured, but are there any specific approaches that you integrate into it?
I think to some degree, Patricia's sort of set it out in for me, it's learning those acceptance and mindfulness skills up front, so that you have some ability to, you know, catch the mental compulsions that can, you know, for some people are the main predominant type of compulsion, and then for other people actually sit below the physical compulsion. So, you know, often I find they sit below there and they stay around even if ERP helps with the physical stuff. So really starting to get those skills in place, you know, also getting that compassionate, flexible stance of ACT up front, because there is so much shame. And especially if you've had some rounds of treatment and you're still struggling, there's even more shame. And, you know, you often people experiencing OCD and anxiety disorders are very nice, understanding, sort of lovely people that are going to blame themselves when things go wrong in the treatment. So there can be all of that shame. So doing some of that work to begin with to, you know, get that core sense of compassion and you know, the psychological flexibility, mindfulness, acceptance skills going, and then bringing in the values, the motivation. So, you know, values, not just as these broad sort of philosophical concepts, but within the domains in life, within the actions that we live them, within the goals, in the person's language, not necessarily an ACT language either, right? You know, sometimes that puts people off. And doing all of that before you start the exposures. And then for me, starting with, if we can do value-based life exposures rather than, you know, anything that you know, seems to pull you away from your life and out of what matters. And then if we still need to, at the end, bringing in some of those targeted exposures that people are still struggling with.
Thank you for that. And just to clarify, I guess, for anyone listening, could you explain value-based exposures versus, say, traditional ERP exposures?
Yeah, so obviously Michael and Patricia would have a lot to say about this, but my own sense of it is that actually it's a bit of a false dichotomy to say CBT doesn't do this, you know, and this is where sometimes some of these arguments are a bit of a straw man argument, that actually if you look at any of these approaches done well, there's more overlap than difference. Mm-hmm. But I guess it's really getting more explicit about what are those qualities of action that matter to someone in their life, the type of person they want to be towards themselves, in relationship, in facing struggles, what do they want to stand for? You know, things like courage and kindness you know, focus and commitment and all those wonderful things. And then, you know, so a value-based exposure is thinking about what does my life look like if I live those values rather than I live avoidance of anxiety and OCD, mm-hmm. what is that life like? And what did I either used to do that reflected that, or what have I not done because of the challenges? And then let's build up the picture of that life, and then that can be the exposure, actually. And kind of what Steve Hayes said from the very beginning, that, you know, it's an exposure therapy at its root because of that, right?
True. Thank you.
I don't have anything to add, but I will say it's heartwarming, Johnny, to hear, you know, like we've never met, and to hear you explain it exactly how I'd explain it, like that, to me, that's really cool that somehow, you know, we're quite a distance apart and we end up in the same place. That's pretty awesome.
Well, thanks for saying that. And yeah. Some of it's the simplicity, right? You know, it's that's the other value of ACT. And I really, I'm a big one for simplicity, because again, going back to my experience of working with clients, people don't remember complex principles and lots of theory and lots of ideas. They'll remember one or two core things, you know, like ACT pushes for.
And if I can add a little bit, I like a lot what you, well, I like Mike's comment, right? I think you're doing such a beautiful work, Johnny. It's such a treat just to have this conversation with you. And as you were saying, I think doing some acceptance work up front before doing exposure makes a difference. One of the things that I noticed, and keep in mind, there are so many ways of delivering ACT, right? I think for me, what I have found is after I have an assessment and I get a sense of what are the obsessions, what are the compulsions, and I map mental compulsions, I have found that it's very helpful to help my clients and to coach them to develop a new relationship with their mind. Because the idea of singing our obsessions or watching our obsessions can be so foreign and so counterintuitive to people if we don't learn to hold our mind lightly. One of the things that we talk in ACT is what we call rule govern behaviors. I talk about ruling thoughts, so that's a little bit more accessible and it's not, you know, full of jargon. But if you think about, in the case of OCD, we do have a lot of beliefs about how we're supposed to think about thinking. Every single thought I have means it's important. If I'm thinking a lot about something, I have to pay attention to this. Because I think so, it makes me so. And I think all those ways of thinking, all those ruling thoughts are driving compulsions, are driving OCD episodes. And I found helpful to help my clients to catch those thoughts and to do diffusion up front. I do a lot of diffusion up front, in particular with thoughts related to thinking. And then we develop the values-based exposure menu. I have found that that's helpful and prepares people to maximize and capitalize any values-based exposure they are doing, because they are holding their mind a little bit lighter, right? I don't know how it's for you guys, but the other thing that is different for me is that I don't start in my first or second session to do exposure right away, because I like to do more, again, that diffusion work up front, looking at rolling thoughts. I develop this values-based exposure menu. When I'm developing this values-based exposure menu, I am not interested in how exact and how perfect it is, whether it's a specific value or not. But I am interested in the conversation in which we can really see how responding to these obsessions with compulsions or with avoidance or reassurance seeking is keeping a person stuck. How they cannot go on a date, how they cannot hold their babies, how they cannot go to even a restaurant. And how will it look like to do all those things in the service of who they want to be? So I think that is not a 5-minute conversation and it's not a one-time thing, but having those elements in place before doing exposure, the diffusion and then the values-based exposure, I think creates so much more a frame of change and context of change for doing this hard thing that is facing exposures.
Really, really good points. Doing the sort of legwork up front to start to shift some of that before going into the exposures and facing those horrible thoughts in most cases and the intense anxiety. Okay, so next question is, I want to talk more about rumination and mental compulsions. It is a big part of compulsions for most people, and often it goes undetected, both from the person with OCD. They don't realize they're ruminating or thinking things through over and over and over again all day, every day. And often, I'm sure many clinicians miss it because it's not shared, because if the person doesn't even know it's happening, why would they share it? How from an ACT point of view, how can we work with rumination, either to identify it, to stop it? Yeah, whatever comes up for you guys.
I guess for me, this is such an important topic, because my own experience of OCD was predominantly mental compulsions, so very few physical compulsions, some, but predominantly mental compulsions. And so I think that you're right. You said it up front, Sue, actually, that this stuff can be so unconscious. I think it's a bit simplistic to say, you know, we have obsessions, we have compulsions, and they're so clear and it's so easy to spot them. And you know, because, right, we're all humans, and even people without experience in OCD reassure themselves in their head, check things, analyze, introspect, you know. So I think to start to get that awareness of your mind and starting to watch your mind and, you know, to look at that interaction between the emotional feelings and the urges and your mind and starting to learn those skills, because most people, I don't think most people can actually just watch their mind and step back and do that. You know, sometimes you hear clinicians speaking and you can kind of hear that they are very focused, very, you know, they're people with good attentional skills in their life. They've had successful careers and maybe their minds are quite easy to pass out into what's what. But actually, for most people with OCD, you know, sometimes people describe it to me like you're a zombie. You don't even know what's going on. You're in this kind of fog, and you know, it can be simplistic to say that it's just anxiety. This obviously there can be disgust, there can be numbness, there can be other emotions driving it. So I think, you know, to start by getting some really good awareness on all those different components and dividing it up, and ACT does a lot on this about, you know, what's going on in the mind, what's going on in the body, what's going on in the urges or action tendencies. So, you know, that's where I think it's so useful. And you know, talking to someone, I guess, as a clinician, you spot the mental compulsions because you hear them, don't you? Right. You know, you hear someone starts to talk and you can see those mental compulsions are being spoken out loud. And then you can kind of target skills in that way as well. And that you know, there's so much that could be said. But I really feel strongly that without some practice and skill in watching your mind, it's so difficult to just catch them. So to start with that training, there's lots of practices to do that. I'm a big Russ Harris fan, and he does a lot of dropping anchor as this primary tool. So using something simple like that, just to start to get some distance and watch your mind, or any of the kind of diffusion techniques, any of the accepting techniques, you know, just starting to get that awareness of what's happening in your mind. And I'm sure everyone else has a lot to say on this topic, though.
Yeah, just say on that, actually, so anyone listening that's interested in the dropping anchor technique, he's got a few free audio versions on his website. So I'll pull out the link and put it in the show notes. Cool. So Michael or Patricia?
We're busy playing with each other. I think when I went to say this very loud and very clear, that ACT targets rumination. So any rumor that ACT doesn't target rumination is incorrect and inaccurate. And I understand that, every model is going to have misconceptions and misunderstandings, but I hope that after this episode, it's fully clear. ACT definitely targets rumination. Johnny, you mentioned something very important. I think one of the things I encountered years ago with my clients and with my students as well is that for me, as you know, my ears were trained to catch when a person is going from having a thought to going to dwelling the thought, the mental compulsions. But I couldn't teach that to my students, right? They would say, but Patricia, how do you know? How do you catch that, right? And I have to think multiple times, how do I teach them to catch that when they are interviewing clients, when they are doing their own assessments, and how do I teach this to my clients? What I have found very helpful is that during my assessments, we do map all the mental compulsions. In my book, I have this very super cool table with maybe, I think, 16 forms of them. But the reason is because when we are doing the assessment, it's important to ask, okay, when obsession comes, when that fear of contamination comes, what do you do in your mind? What's the thinking strategy you're trying to use? And they can vary in form. They can be very simple, like saying a prayer, saying a sentence, counting, but they can go into more elaborated forms, like figuring things out in the past, right? Ruminating, anticipating future situations, dwelling on existential issues. And what I found is that if we can provide that education and coach people, okay, you know, if you don't do this thinking strategy, if you don't use the thinking strategy, what happens? That's looking at a function, right, of that particular compulsion. Then we know it's a mental compulsion. Because the tricky thing with mental compulsions and ruminations is that they are regular thinking strategies that every single human being does. It's in the context they became problematic because they're trying to reduce the anxiety that comes with the obsession. So I think for me, it started with checking how they look, what are the thinking strategies a person is using, and what's the impact of them. That will be one thing. The other misconception that sometimes people have, and very, very valid. Of course, in the ACT model, we're super happy to talk about acceptance, right? Really, we breathe and live acceptance. The challenge is that in the case of OCD in particular, it's very important to distinguish. And you guys may have a different take about this. But sometimes the way that I think of is that we're talking about acceptance to the obsession, to the yucky thought that comes when I have that intrusive and unwanted thought. We're not talking about acceptance of the compulsion, which is very important to distinguish. It's like if I have a thought, am I going to die young in a car accident? I want to practice acceptance to that. But if I go into, is it possible I'm going to die tomorrow? Should I drive tomorrow? Should I call someone to drive me to work, right? If I go into that, we're not talking about accepting that response, the mental response. So I think something to clarify, when we talk about acceptance, we're not trying to send a passive message. It's actually very empowering to learn that I can have the obsession, I can make room for it, and I can choose how to respond to it without using these thinking strategies. And if it's okay, I just have another, I think, third point, if I can add. I think we all have moments in our life in which we go into rabbit holes, thinking and thinking, overthinking and overthinking. We're trying to solve so many things in our head, right? I don't think any human being walks in life without being stuck, for hours, sometimes dwelling and dwelling. Mm-hmm. Maybe that happens to me every day, but that's a different one. But one of the things that happens with OCD, it's very distressing and it's very debilitating. I know I have seen, I see the fear, I see the pain that my clients go through. And I know in my own life how it is to be stuck in your head. In those moments, as Johnny was saying, there are many things that you can do. One of the things that I teach my clients is also choosing what they are going to pay attention to. What's really important this moment between you and I, here we are, and we're trying to, face this fear, right? And then the mind is going blah, blah, blah. What's really important right now between you and I? How do you want to respond to that? That building that capacity to choose a micro response in the moment, I think it's really, really empowering for people, and it's a skill that you can build up. But it also comes with that many times that feelings in the body are very overwhelming. So we can use drop on the ankle or pressing your feet really hard or just taking a deep breath. That doesn't mean we're teaching clients distraction as a quick fix. Mm. It means that we're teaching clients to choose how to respond to that internal response. So I think the frame, how we're using this, right? It's not to tell when you're doing a mental composure, you have to do this. Mm. To me, the question is, when you are noticing that obsession coming up in your mind, that annoying thought, how do you want to respond to it? What do you need to do to just hang in there a little bit with your body so you can choose what to do with that? That's very different than when you have an obsession, make sure you do some grounding. So it's just some, I think for me, I have found those things helpful.
Yeah, thank you. And Michael, was it ever addressed in the literature or talked about or identified at all? I'd say literature, like the research.
Around this...
Rumination
or
mental
worry.
Compulsions, yeah.
Not that I've ever seen. Hmm. I mean, I know in CBT they did a trial just around these kind of compulsions or obsessions and compulsions, but we haven't in ACT. I mean, I see why you asked the question. It's, to me, this is one of the more complicated moments when this is what my client is presenting with. But I think Patricia and Johnny did a fantastic job answering it.
Excellent. No worries. Maybe that's the next trial. Specifically,
that's right.
Rumination. Okay. So my next question is, yeah. So Johnny, you mentioned it earlier, but for all three of you, how does ACT approach differing uncomfortable emotions that go along with OCD? So such as disgust, uncertainty, numbness, lack of feeling. I guess we could throw guilt into there as well.
Shame.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Is there anything you three have on that? Be good.
Well, I'll jump in if it's okay. Because this sort of, when I was thinking about the last question, this sort of ties in a little bit to that same idea. When I think like big picture, even if I had a client who didn't have OCD, like if there's something I really wanted to teach them to do, besides making your life about pursuing values, not controlling emotion, but it's seeing the function of our inner experiences seeing the function of our behavior in response to our inner experiences and choosing how we're going to let those things push us around, or even seeing the function of our behavior in response to external things. And I think if people can learn to track, like, why am I doing what I'm doing in this moment? Like, what is this about? Like, even me talking right now, like, why am I speaking right now? Is it to look smart, or is it to be helpful, or to be to like do my part in this podcast? If we can link our behavior to the functions that we actually care about, then I don't know, things kind of go pretty well in life. And I kind of like that about ACT, because, and I hope I'm answering your question, because that works well for OCD, that works well for depression, that works well for how do I treat my grad students, how do I behave as a dad, like tracking the function of behavior is just, if you can do that globally, it addresses so many of these things. And I think that was your question, like how do you get at all these different different types of problems that go along with OCD. I think that blanket idea is pretty cool because it taps into a whole lot of things we do as humans.
Yeah, nice. I like it. And
I think learning skills to handle different emotions is such a core part of OCD recovery. And as Patricia said earlier, it's rare that you're going to get someone with this sort of just purely only OCD they're struggling with. There's such a complex, almost it's an artificial setup, because actually all humans struggle with different emotions, don't we, at times. And I think for us all to learn skills to handle that and to sort of not be controlled by those emotions for me was key. I think OCD was about the difficult thoughts and urges and images and all of that stuff, but it was also about trying to get rid of these really difficult feelings and like not wanting to feel anxious ever, not wanting to feel depersonalized ever, not wanting, you know, wanting to desperately get rid of that. And actually, you know, it's so liberating to change it around that you're not trying to get rid of that with the treatment. You're actually trying to learn how to be with that better. And then the nice thing is that, yeah, often it'll drop down, it'll reduce, or it'll change, but maybe it won't, you know, for some people, maybe it won't, but you know, you live in your life. I can tell you, I wouldn't have been able to do this podcast without ACT and those skills. You know, I could barely public speak when I was younger. Well, I couldn't, you know, I couldn't do it at all. So without those skills, you know, and they're going to show up in people with OCD. It's not going to just be around the, you know, these, the mental, the intrusive thoughts. Is also going to be all these different feelings that are showing up in their life that they're struggling with. And to have a skill set and have a kind of methodological way of training that ability to have acceptance is really useful, I think.
Thank you.
If I can add a little bit, Johnny, I love how you are normalizing. It's human experience to have these intense emotions. One of the things that I have found many times with my clients is that as they are facing their values-based exposures, their values-guided exposures, they do have, you know, tons of mini emotional roller coasters, right? Emotions can be, you know, very overwhelming. You see the fear, you feel the terror. But also, I think it's important what you were saying, Johnny, and you also say that, Mike, moments ago, that normalizing that experience as part of being alive, instead of addressing an emotion as something that we have to solve, a math problem that we have to solve. The most common question we hear, and I'm sure we all have heard this and experienced this, like, I want to get rid of this feeling. Why I'm feeling this way? I don't want to feel this. I usually may ask questions, how is that showing up in your body? Is there a beginning or an end of an emotion? How will that look like? What's the shape of that, right? Just those may sound like very silly questions, but what we're doing is helping people to have micro approximations with that experience that hurts, that is annoying. Their emotions, they don't have to be our enemies. They can be our friends. But I think not going into a problem-solving mode of emotion is key. Modeling that, yeah, emotions come and go. It's not something that we have to solve right away. And see which emotions we can learn from and which emotions we can toss. Right. And that's also important, because many times there is this idea that we have to analyze every emotion. Right. But no, some emotions we learn and others we just have to let them go.
Yeah. Yeah. Really, really good points. Right. What would be the next best question? I guess, is there anything else we want to say? So, Patricia, you started talking about comorbidities earlier. And Michael, you obviously just talked, again, you brought it in. But I guess I just wanted to see if we could spend a couple more minutes on comorbidities, because as you say, so many people, it's not just OCD, it's depression, GAD, general anxiety disorder, perfectionism. And even beyond comorbidities, it's I've had a falling out with my mum. You know, I haven't spoken to my brother in however long. I've been unemployed for 5 years. It's other stuff and that isn't in the DSM, you know, which I guess we could pile under comorbidities. Yes, is there anything else anyone wants to share on that?
I think there's a link to trauma often as well, you know, not saying OCD is caused by trauma, but I know this many times, the people I've worked with, when you track back the history, there is sometimes big traumas and sometimes little relational ongoing invalidation and lack of that secure base and that loving presence in their childhood. And, you know, to just ignore that completely, I think it is risky. I think sometimes to do the exposure work, to have, you know, that relationship Patricia talked about earlier with your mind, where you can be kind of more friendly and playful, I think it's impossible to do that if you're feeling that high degree of shame and pain because of your history and you think you're a terrible person because of what your mind's doing. So, you know, I think ACT helps with, you know, when we can do that history and look at, you know, what are the lessons we've learned about emotions along the way from our significant people in our life and all of that. And sort of comorbidity. Yeah. You know, those, the more complex versions of OCD, you know, sometimes, you know, it's like, the theme is one thing, but there is something in their life I've noticed that can be significantly linked to that area. So it's not that the theme has any relevance to their life, but it is almost a signal about, you know, pain in relationships or immense self-criticism or lack of safety and security. So to not tackle that at all as well, I think can really limit probably long-term recovery. And certainly that's what I've noticed in people that have reached out to me. Sometimes they feel like the ERP approach kind of invalidated some of that suffering and sort of went, well, don't worry about that, just do these exposures sort of thing. And of course, not every ERP therapist is going to do that, not every CBT, you know, there's huge compassion and all of that within those modalities, but sometimes I think that's the risk, and I think that's where ACT can be helpful.
Yeah, that's a beautiful response. I think for me, I completely relate with your sharing, Johnny, on the sense that there is OCD and there is life getting messy in many areas of our life. And I think we cannot isolate our clients, you know, struggles with OCD from that context in which they are living and the relations they are trying to have. One of the things I have witnessed, and of course, I have a very biased opinion here, is that I don't think I knew, honestly, when I was doing traditional ERP to help my clients to face life stuff. I don't think I had a repertoire of skills from a place of humbleness and maybe my own limitation. But I think what I have witnessed the last hundreds of years, dinosaur delivering ACT, I have seen that teaching psychological flexibility, helping my clients to develop a new way of relating to their own thinking, to their fears, to not knowing, to uncertainty, are life skills that go beyond treatment. And if we can teach a person to always go back to their values, in the middle of a divorce, in the middle of a breakup, in the middle of choosing the partner that you want to spend the rest of your life, that's, a humongous, humongous shift that I have seen in my work. So I think the ACT skills are transferable to life, to any situation you are living in life, beyond that, just dealing with OCD or just doing a life-based exposure.
I think, just to highlight something you said that resonated with me was going back to your values over and over again. Because like you said, you mentioned a divorce there, and it could be a loss of someone or a job loss. And I guess when we get stuck in all those circumstances are inevitably going to trigger very intense emotions in us. And in those times, I guess it's easier to forget values. And maybe we'll act in ways that aren't aligned with our values, and that will probably cause regret later on, which is a whole nother problem. So I guess even in those times, reminding oneself to come back to the values can make us make healthy choices that make that pain that's already there no more painful than it needs to be.
It's a huge shift, right? To imagine that if you're done with treatment, you're in recovery, that if you're applying for a new job, if you're changing careers, right? That asking yourself, what's really important for me about this? What's really important to me in this moment? I think it's an incredible, powerful question that we can ask ourselves.
Absolutely. And Michael, was there anything you wanted to add there? So you unmuted yourself.
No, I don't think so. I mean, I'm not trying to bail out. I've loved what's been offered, and I could repeat it, but I think they answered it wonderfully.
Yeah, no, that's okay. And from the research point of view, when you, in your various studies you've done over the years and in your clinic, how often do you control for comorbidities? Do you leave them in, or do you take them out on average?
Well, I don't know if you, I mean, those of you looking, if you saw me looking to the right, I did pull up a paper. That's a finding. So a moderation study is, you know, pre-study characteristics that predict outcome. So one would be how many comorbid conditions. And one variable that keeps showing up in ACT studies is greater number of comorbid conditions, greater treatment failures is predictive of better outcomes compared to comparison conditions. So that does say something. And so the more treatment failures that, you know, presenting creative hopelessness and acceptance and you know, diffusion and stepping back seems more logical if other attempts to regulate the internal experience fell apart. Mm-hmm. And then the comorbid conditions, I think everything that Johnny and Patricia and you, Stuart, have said, that that's one of the things I've loved about ACT. And I don't mean to sound like an ACT cheerleader, but I am pleased that it's the therapy that I sort of fell into when I was younger, because it as a model matches almost everything that comes my way. I mean, there are things where it doesn't match, but you know, sometimes I get presented with things that are, I mean, they're new. It's a new presentation, but if I find the internal experience that's pushing the person in a direction they don't want to go, I can teach acceptance and diffusion around that internal experience, help them connect to their values. And then we can move towards it. And so it's nice. It's like when I started learning behavior analysis, like I knew how I could use it with just about most problems. And I sort of feel the same way about ACT. So if I get a client who's, you know, having issues with their family, issues with their religion and OCD, the model is probably going to go across all three of those in a pretty seamless way. And I kind of like that.
Yeah, absolutely. I guess this goes back to, it goes against the DSM and the diagnostic model, but it kind of implies that suffering is a human condition, and we categorize it and we label it, but really it's a continuum, you know, and it's fluid. Yeah.
You look throughout history, you look about anyone that's done, you know, some significant behavior change, you so often find values as part of that, and there's a strong motivation. It's not, you know, sometimes the cost provides some motivation, but so often it's like, what do I want to move towards? Historically, you know, acceptance, you find it in every world culture, you know, you find it across the board. Exposure you do, of course, as well, you know, you find it in all ancient traditions, and, you know, it long predates, you know, its modern form. So, yeah, I think the process model is so useful with ACT, that it's going for what processes are useful and work and most simple, you know, how can we boil it down most simply? And that speaks to me, because I really think when you go into therapy, you're so overwhelmed, it's hard to concentrate, it's hard to listen to your therapist, you know, you can barely take in half of what they say, you know, so if you're having some complex theory or if you don't have a very simplistic model, I think it's really tough when you're in that place.
Yeah, absolutely. I guess my last question for you guys is, Germany, if any of you want to expand on values, because you've all addressed it, but I haven't explicitly asked this. If there's anything else you want to add, and also I think I'll just add some detail to that. It's come up several times on the podcast where people say, you know, for example, if you take washing compulsions, they were doing that 6-7 hours a day. Now they don't do it. And now they've got this huge time in their life, which is wonderful, but they don't know who they are and how to fill that time. And then if they don't know who they are and how to fill that time, there's this big 7-hour period each day where other negative experiences or uncomfortable experiences could creep in and lead to depression or whatever it is. So I guess how would someone like that use values to really start filling that time with things that are important to them? Everyone's nodding, I should say.
I'll offer a third of the answer. Okay. And I think a third of the answer is do your values imperfectly. As long as you're following something of meaning in those moments, that's awesome. I think people get caught in their heads like, is this the best way to spend this hour? It'll always be a mediocre way to spend that hour. You will never choose the perfect thing. You'll never align your day perfectly. But if you are at least spending a chunk of your day going towards values, that is a great step. And then in the future, you can worry about aligning it better.
Mm. Nice.
I think there's something around using the skills together. You know, if you have OCD, your mind's going to get into values and start going, what are they? You know, it might bring your themes in, or at the very least, you're going to start to get confused about, is this the right value? Is this not? And I think that's why Steve Hayes makes such a big thing about it. It's a choice. We choose to do them. We don't have to justify it. So doing that diffusion work with it and that acceptance work with it, so that if your mind tries to tangle up with it, you know, you can work with that. And then the present moment piece speaks to me, you know, and what Michael was saying, you know, actually you can choose anything if you're in the present moment. You know, flow is what people report is you know, some of the most meaningful experiences in your life. And you can get flow doing a jigsaw puzzle, mountain biking, talking to someone you love, eating a meal. So to some degree, it's sort of the data is in living it. And then you kind of test out your values as you live in them and see if it's working for you and can reshape it if you need to.
Yeah. I think what comes up for me there, Johnny, is because a question that also came to my mind that I probably should have asked you is, how do you define your values? There are obviously things, tests online and stuff like that. And I guess you could just think what's important to me. But where was I going with that point? I guess what you were saying, what came to me is it's like, just start doing things that you're interested in or you find meaningful, and you almost define your values as you go. You know, like, oh, I helped someone out today. Oh, maybe I'm caring is an important value of mine. Or, you know, you'll learn as you go through living.
If I can add one of the stuck points that sometimes I have here in my work is that now that I have this time, exactly as you were saying, what do I do? And I don't know whether my values are, because everything was organized about around my obsessions. Mm-hmm. And I think in moments like that, sometimes we do a list of maybe 10 things a person will be curious to do. I am not shooting for like a perfect value, but I think we won't know what speaks to our heart and what's our value without trying things. We won't understand our values by thinking about them, but by taking action, right? And that's what I think, Johnny, you were saying that. I think anything we can do, we will discover that some things can be very revitalizing for us, right?
Yeah, nice. Really good points. So lastly then, is there anything else you three wish you could have said or shared today? So, Michael, if we start with you.
Oh, my gosh, you're throwing me... out there first. I was like, oh, good thing. I can wait and see if something comes to my mind. Oh my gosh. You did this to me at the end of our other podcast. You asked me 3 questions. Do you ask everybody those 3 questions?
Most of the time, yeah.
I was like, I walked away and I was like, I should have listened to a podcast first. I could have seen them coming. instead I had a on the spot. Is there anything I wish I shared? I don't know. No, I mean, okay. I was thinking one thing. It's going to be now what you were guessing, but Stuart, I'm really, really like, I think on this concept of values, I think what you're doing is really, really cool. Like when I look at how many people view this and like, even what I get out of listening to Johnny and Patricia talk about this, like, this is a cool thing. And like, okay. I think you're making a big difference. Like in my life and other professionals and parents and people with OCD. So, you know, keep doing this. This is cool. So I'll take my little second to say thanks to you for doing this. Yeah. I've been thinking that a lot as I've been listening.
Thank you, Michael. It means a lot.
Yeah.
Patricia?
Oh boy. I go next.
I'm going in order of my screen.
Oh, got it. If there is anything else I wish I had say, a lot of thoughts are coming into my mind. I'm trying to be respectful of everyone's time and answering the question versus giving background information, of course. I think maybe one mini tip or advice for people listening to this podcast, whether you are a person dealing with OCD or you're a clinician or a mental health provider, I think I will invite you to consider that within ACT, the invitation is to face your fears, not in a mechanical way or as something that you check off from a list, but we're more invested in the processing, how you do it, why you do it, and what shows up when you're facing that. I think asking yourself those three questions every time you're facing an exposure, it will just help you to navigate those situations in a more skillful way in the long way. But that will be my tiny thing.
Nice. Thank you.
Yeah, I would echo, you know, what everyone said, and especially what Michael said about what a cool thing this is, and that, you know, this is living your values, right? This is it, you know, and you took a brave move doing this, and look at where you are now. And I think related to that, you know, for anyone listening to this, to really also listen to your own experience. You know, sometimes you go into therapy and you working with a therapist is incredibly confident, very intelligent, highly trained, and there can be this sense of, okay, it must be what they're saying. But, you know, to also listen to yourself a bit, and if what we've said today has spoken to you, then to give it a try, and you know, you've got to let your experience be what, you know, what teaches you and how you learn how to manage and work with this incredibly painful, you know, life-destroying disorder. So, you know, trusting your own experience in that, and that's hard to do when you're in that kind of really fight or flight, you know, really disorientated place. But, you know, taking some time and doing that is so important.
Absolutely. Well, Michael, Patricia, and Johnny, thank you so much for doing my first roundtable ever. It was definitely challenged my podcasting skills, but it's been a fun time, and I've learned a lot as well. So, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you. Great to talk to you guys.
Thank you for listening to this week's podcast. If you enjoy the OCD Stories podcast and would like to support us with a one-time tip/donation, please go to theocdstories.com/support. All tips, no matter how large or small, are greatly appreciated. Please subscribe and rate the show wherever you listen to the podcast. Thanks also to NoCD for sponsoring the show. For more information, please click the link in the episode description. A quick disclaimer, this podcast is not therapy. It is not a replacement for therapy. Please seek treatment from a trained professional. And until we speak, take care.